So I presume everyone has gotten some start on the project. Okay, remember that it's due next week. Okay, so make sure you start, and if you have any problems, come and talk to us. Okay.
So I have one question. If you all have used Java, one of the things was, like, I think in the inodes you had like a integer array to store the pointers, but in Java, since you can copy the copies by reference, can we just have like a character array?
Did you say you could?
I told them they can either code in.
Oh, I see. Okay, you're not supposed to use Java, but maybe in IDEO use Java. So, what was the question? You have integer array, and
right.
What you can do what?
Well, you have an integer array because
right.
You're supposed to like,
sure.
Store the pointers.
That's the I know.
But,
yeah.
Right, but in Java you can copy by reference. So I was just wondering, like, if you can character array instead.
So you have to, so the I'm just trying to think through what you're asking. So you have to make sure everything that is in an inode is persistent on disk. So if you shut down your program and then you restart it, you can read that inode back from disk and recreate everything. Okay, so it's not just memory manipulation of arrays. You have to, your file system has to have a persistent state on disk. It means not only should the files be stored on disk, all of the inodes should also be on disk, should be flushed on disk. You can have copies of the inodes in memory when you open files or when you manipulate files. But anytime you change it, you should flush it back to disk, so that if you shut your file system process that you're writing down completely, the disk is, the virtual disk is an actual file on your real disk. When you restart it and it attaches itself back, everything should be as is. So that's the reason we have let. So you can think through whether that condition is met or not. Okay. So don't think about just memory. Think about on-disk state also. Any other question here in the project? Yes, your
own. I have a bit of a bigger question about our syllabus. What does the how much is homework worth? Is there two contradictory things?
Homework, so exams 40%, two exams, 20 each, projects 40%, and homeworks plus any in-class participation, we had one in-class assignment fairly early on, all that is collectively 20%. So, since we will only have three homeworks, so they would be either worth 4 or 5% each. Okay, that's the way we are going to do it. Does that answer your question? Okay. What is the inconsistency you are mentioning?
Because someone else in the syllabus a bit below that said it was 50% in the test and 50% on the project.
Really?
Yeah, the one on the site, the one year early slide, says what you did.
I have to go look. I don't think, well, the homeworks are worth something. So it's 40-40, 20 was, 20 included homeworks plus in-class participation for any small assignments we did, etc., etc. That's the way I had intended. I'll go look, make sure that this problem is addressed. Otherwise, I mean, you have no motivation to do the homework. It is worth 0%.
Plus the homework worth the project,
right? Yeah. Yep. Okay. So let's get started here. So last time, we basically had a quick introduction of what a network does. Okay, so here is the thing that you should take away from it. So when processes run on different machines in a distributed system, they communicate with each other using the notion of messages. Okay, and the way a network instantiates these messages is by sending packets from one machine to another that might be relayed by intermediate routers. As far as an application is concerned, messages could be of arbitrary size. Okay? So you can think of HTTP messages. You request a page, the page could be of arbitrary size. It may be 4 kilobytes, it may be 20 kilobytes, doesn't matter. Okay? Now, when a network actually sends those messages, okay, it chops them up into fixed size chunks. Okay, so packets themselves have limited size. Packets cannot be of arbitrary size. So if an application message exceeds the size of a packet, the message must be chopped up into smaller packets and each packet sent independently and reassembled at the other end. Okay? So arbitrary size messages are implemented as fixed size packets. Okay? Messages tend to be ordered. When an application sends messages or one process sends messages to another process, you expect that if A was sent before B, then at the other end A is received before B. Okay? Now this is not true, although we didn't discuss this point last time. This is not true as far as packets are concerned. If you send two packets into the network, they may arrive in opposite order at the other end. The network does not necessarily preserve message ordering. Okay. Now it is up to the protocols to figure out whether they want to restore message ordering. So TCP, for instance, will reorder these messages to so that you get them in the same order in which they were sent. UDP will not, because UDP doesn't do any extra work. Okay. Now messages, you expect messages to be reliable, which means if you send out a message, you expect that it is received at the other end, so long as there is no network fault or anything like that. Now, packets may not be reliable. We talked about UDP and TCP. If you are using UDP as your transport protocol, you do not get reliable delivery. Okay? UDP is a best effort service. It does not guarantee that a packet that is sent will be received. Okay? So packets may be lost inside the network. Okay? Whenever there is congestion, a router could drop packets. Okay? Because it does not have sufficient buffers or memory to store all the packets that are coming in. Okay? And it's up to the protocols again to figure out, or protocols or the application to figure out which packets were lost and retransmit them. Okay? Messages go from process to process. Okay, there are processes that are running on machines. They are the ones sending messages to one another. So when a message is handed to the operating system kernel, the packet that results from these messages are sent from machine to machine. So the address on the packet, okay, for the destination is the machine address, not the process address. Okay. Messages are synchronous, which we will talk about, but packets are sent asynchronously, and messages, you expect them to be secure, okay, but the packets, underlying packets, are insecure. You don't know what happens when you send out a packet in the network. Somebody could capture those packets and look inside them and whatnot. So if you are interested in secure communication, you have to encrypt the contents of a message, which means that the packet has encrypted data. Okay, so if somebody intercepts these messages, they don't know what's inside there. Okay. So now as far as the rest of this discussion is concerned, we are actually going to assume a reliable end-to-end message delivery. Okay. So assume that you have something like TCP that ensures reliability and it ensures message ordering and whatnot. If you want security, you can add security on top by using things like encryption. Okay. So let's assume that. Let's not worry about any of these problems that arise inside the network. We'll assume that the protocol stack that we looked at last time takes care of all of these problems. Okay. So today, so what we are going to now do is start looking at some of these other things that we had put up last time. Say, what is it that a distributed system gives us? Okay? Gives us the ability to share resources. Okay? Now, what it complicates is that you need synchronization. You have multiple processes that are communicating with each other, coordinating to achieve some task. So you have to do synchronization. No different from when you had multiple threads that were trying to do something together, you have to implement synchronization. Okay? Now, distributed synchronization is something we will not talk about here. Okay? This is an advanced topic. So if you take something like a graduate course in operating systems, something like 677 that I actually teach here, that's where we look at how do you take the notion of a lock, okay, and make it distributed. So two processes running on two arbitrary machines can share a lock. Okay. Thus far, the notion of locks and so on were confined to the same machine, okay, and many times to the same process. So if, when you use pthread mutexes, you assume that all of the processes were running on the same machine. But what happens if they are not and they want to synchronize? How do you generalize this concept? So that's something you will ignore, okay, but something that's still important. Critical sections are the same way. You need to extend the notion of a critical section across machines, okay, when they are sharing some resources. Again, that's a problem that we will ignore here. Okay, deadlock detection, recovery, failure recovery are all harder, okay, when you have multiple machines. Okay, and so you need to figure out when machine may fail. If there is a deadlock, how, what you can do about it. So in other words, lot of the concepts that we learned in this class assume that processes were all running on the same machine. Okay? But the same problems arise even when processes don't run on the same machine in distributed systems. Okay. synchronization, multiple processes trying to coordinate, deadlocks occurring, recovering from them, and so on. Okay, so implementing these same abstractions across machines is an interesting topic in a distributed systems course. Okay, now this is not a course in distributed systems. We just have a few lectures that we are going to look at. So many of these topics we will not look in more detail, but something you should be aware of, that these problems actually get harder. Okay, but we will look at, what we will look at are, is the first bullet in a lot more detail. Okay, how resource sharing helps in distributed systems. Okay, so to understand how you can fundamentally share resources, okay, let's look at several mechanisms that are used. Okay, so we look at three mechanisms: data migration, computation migration, and job migration. Okay, in data migration, you are basically sharing data across processes, and data can move from one machine to another. Okay, processes stay where they are on their own machines, and the data moves. Okay. In computation, migration is the other way around. Okay. The data stays on certain machines, it's the computation or the processes that move around, okay, and access data, and then they move to other machines. Okay. And job migration actually involves both data and computation migration. So let's look at each of this in more detail. Okay. Now the basic trade-off in resource sharing is that you want fast, and you want to share resources so that you can access these resources as fast as possible and as cheaply as possible. Okay? But many times speed and cost don't go well together. Okay? What may be fast may not be cheap. What may be cheap may not be fast. Okay? And so that's a trade-off that we'll have to look at. And let's try to understand how to go about doing this. Okay, so now, let's try to understand some fundamental trade-offs here. So let's assume there are two machines, okay, and there's a network. So in the first case, let's assume that communication is fast and also cheap. Okay, so in this case, it's easy for us to access resources in the environment. So let's just take the standard example of, there's a data here, and there's a process here. Okay. This process is trying to access data on that machine. Okay. Now, if this is a fast network, okay, you can access this data quickly without any problem. So, if this is a gigabit link, a gigabit Ethernet, okay, so then access to data is fast. Okay. Now, as opposed to this, let's suppose you are on a dial-up modem connection. You still have connection to the data, but this is a slow link and it's a low bandwidth link. So if you are accessing a lot of data, that's going to be slow. Okay. Now how you design your application in these two environments will differ dramatically. It also depends on the connection speed. Okay. In one case, you can actually get access online. In another case, since you have slow connections, you might actually have local caches, so most of the data accesses happen locally with infrequent access to a remote resource. Okay. So in other words, you have to keep in mind what the environment is providing you and design your applications or distributed systems accordingly. Okay. And this is basically something we will come back to as we look at next time we are going to start looking at distributed file systems. Okay. In this context, we'll look at what you need to do at the client end and what you need to do at the server end, depending on different scenarios. Okay. Now, this is very abstract discussion as thus far, but these are trade-offs you need to understand. When you start designing distributed systems, you have to look at what are you accessing, how easy or cheap is it to access that resource remotely, and then make appropriate design decisions. Okay. Now, with that background in mind, let's go back to these three techniques that I put up there: data migration, computation migration, and job migration. Okay. And let's keep this picture in mind. Okay. So, what is data migration? So, as I mentioned, in this notion of data migration, your processes, okay, your multiple machines. Let's just ignore some of this. You have a distributed system with multiple processes. Okay. and their processes are basically doing some computation on the data. So in the notion of data migration, the data that you are accessing hops from one or migrates from one process to another as the process needs it. Okay? And the process then does some transformations on the data, and then the data moves elsewhere and so on. And processes stay where they are, is data that's moving around. Okay? Now, how could you go about doing this when network access is fast and cheap versus network access is not? Okay? So, if you go and look at this data and process example that I just put up, you have two possibilities. Okay? You can copy files, or you can provide remote access. Okay? So when you design the same set of applications is different in the two scenarios. So let's assume that you have a disk here and there's a file stored on this disk, and all three processes need access to this file. Okay? Now if the network is fast, okay, and you have high good bandwidth connection, then what you would want to do is provide remote access to this file. So all of these processes are just accessing the file remotely. Okay, meaning you can send read or write requests to a remote disk and the disk executes it for you. Okay. Now on the other hand, if the network is slow, then you want to basically do that, which is when this process wants to access it, you bring the file over once and then you do a lot of local accesses. Okay, and when this process wants the file, then the file actually hops from here to here and you do a lot of local accesses. And when this process wants to access the file and so on. So the file actually keeps moving around. Okay. Now why is it that the two techniques provide us different trade-offs? Okay, let's try to think about that. When would you do this versus when would you do this? In terms of data migration. Yes.
Depending on the size of the file that's being transferred. If
yes.
It's too large, then you wouldn't really want to transfer it across the network.
Yes. So let's assume this is a database. Okay. And you have 1 gigabyte database. Okay. File is very large. So if this process wants, so let's now make this a little more concrete. Let's suppose that's a database and this is a process that's trying to run a query on this database. Suppose that's a catalog of books and you're just trying to look in the database to see if there are some books that match certain terms. Let's say you want to search for all books on operating systems and this is a database or catalog that your library maintains. Okay. Now typically these catalogs are large, so if you want, it's not very cheap to transfer a very large file over the network. Okay. So in this case you provide remote access where the query is actually sent over to the data and then you access the results there and only get the results that you want. Okay. Now on the other hand, so this is one extreme. Okay. Very large data and fast network. The other extreme is small files. Let's say you have 1 kilobyte file, or let's just make it 10 kilobyte. But this is a very slow dial-up link, and you're doing a lot of I.O. to this file. Okay. So every I.O., every request to read a small chunk of this file takes a long latency because this is a slow dial-up link. Okay. Is this clear or not what I'm just saying? So what you would rather do is pay the one-time cost of bringing this file over the network. You just download the whole file and do all the operations locally. Okay? So you pay this one-time cost of bringing the file over a network, and then maybe you do 10,000 I/O operations, all of them locally, but they run very fast. Okay? And then once you are done, then you can send the file back. Okay. We look at this exact concepts when we do distributed file system. Okay. Early distributed file system use one of two models, what's called a remote access model and an upload-download model. The remote access model, the file always stays on the server, you send requests to read or write to the file to the server and the server just sends back results. In the upload-download model, you actually download the file, do all the operations locally, and when you close the file, you send it back. Okay. These are exactly the two techniques that you have in the context of data migration. Okay. And which one is useful depends on what kind of network do you have, what's the size of the data. Okay. If the data is large, you would rather keep it remote and send operations over. The data is small but the network is slow, you would rather bring the file locally and do all the operations locally. Okay. Okay. So the next problem is what is called computation migration. So in this case, data is not going to move. The problem is where should the computation, where should the processing of the data occur? Okay. As the name suggests, in the computation migration, you are actually a program travels to the data. Okay. And it does processing where the data is and the result comes back to you. Okay. Now this may sound overly complex, but there is something that happens all the time. When you actually go into Google, okay, and you type a search query, okay, what you have effectively done is your query is a program. Okay, the query says, find me all web pages that have these index terms or these that have these keywords. Okay? So now your browser doesn't have the index locally, so your browser has actually sent the query off to Google server. So your program has actually traversed to where the data is. Okay, data is actually on Google servers. So you send off your query there, your program executes where the data is and the results come back to you. Okay? This is a very simple example of computation migration. Okay? Now there are more complex examples where there are real applications, not just a small query that are actually hopping from one machine to another where the data is. But even simple scenarios like sending off a search in a search engine is an example of this. Okay. Same is true of database query. Okay. You can construct a small SQL query, which is a program, okay, and you send it off to the server. So the SQL query goes over a network to a database server. The database server executes it. It finds all matching records and it sends it back to you. Okay. Another example of computation migration. Okay. Now, we will see a generic way to do this computation migration, and that is what we will call remote procedure calls. Okay, later on in this today's class. So let me tell you what is this notion of a remote procedure call. So remote procedure calls are also called RPCs. Okay, in the Java world they are called RMIs. If you have heard any of these terms, then you should sort of have an idea of what this does. Okay. So let's try to understand the rationale behind doing it. Okay. So if you take a typical distributed application or a distributed system, what the system is doing is there are these processes that send messages to one another, and each process does some processing when a message is received. Okay. So one way to implement your distributed application is to send messages that are essentially function calls. Okay. And that is what a remote procedure call does. So in this case, let's just take two machines here. Okay. So there's a process running here and it implements some functions or method. Let's say it implements the foo method and the bar method. Okay. Here's another process, okay, that wants to access some of the functionality of this method. So one thing it could do is basically say, execute the foo method with these arguments. Let's say it will send you an int and a float. And it sends this message over. Okay? And this application or this process here executes the foo method with these arguments and sends the result back. Okay? Is this clear what I just said? Okay, so your process has some methods that it has implemented. And other processes can call those methods, okay, with arguments. Okay. So the abstraction you are provided to your application designer is the same abstraction that you are used to, which is calling methods or functions. Okay. So just as you can call a local function with an argument, you are calling a remote method. Okay. All of the magic of figuring out where this process is on the network, creating a message, sending it over, all that is not done by the application programmer. The underlying runtime system takes care of it automatically for you. Okay? So you can write distributed applications exactly the way you write centralized applications. Okay? You basically partition the functionality into methods. It just so happens that certain methods now just live on a different process, on a different machine, rather than all of them being on the same, you know, within the same program. So whenever you can call local methods or you can call remote methods. When you call remote methods, the underlying runtime system actually intercepts these method calls and sends off a message, gets the method executed and gives you back the results. Okay. So from a programmer standpoint, this is a very powerful technique. Okay, you can write a distributed system without worrying about all these underlying problems of how to set up a TCP connection and how to communicate over the TCP. All that is hidden from the application program. And we'll see examples of how you can write remote procedures a little later. Okay. So before then, we'll come back to RPC. So let's finish up our discussion. So job migration basically happens when both the computation and the data can both move. In data migration, we said processes don't move, processes stay on the server, the data moves around. The data goes from one machine to another and goes to where the process is. In computation migration is the other way around. Data stays where it is, programs traverse across the network to where the data is and processing is done locally. Okay. In job migration, both the data and the processes can move. Okay. And there are many examples of systems where job migrations occur. Okay. So the simplest way to think about this is if you have used this systems like SETI at home. Okay. Has anybody heard of SETI at home? Okay. So several people have heard of SETI at home. So what does this do? Okay. So basically this is a way by which you can donate unused cycles on your machine for a good cause. Okay, so in this case, the cause just happens to be, okay, maybe it's not a good cause, for some cause that you probably like or believe in. And that's not the only, there are people that are doing cancer research and what, right, folding, yes. So the basic idea is there is a server somewhere. Okay. That has work that it wants to give out. Okay? And there are machines elsewhere. And when these machines are idle cycles, they just contact the server saying, send me some work. Okay? So the server sends a small piece of computation and a small piece of data and say, go run this computation and do this processing on the data. So some data and computation moves come over the network and basically they execute in your screensaver in this case. Okay, not all job migration has to happen this way, but this is just an example of a scenario where there is job migration. So there is some job that the server wants to do. It is partitioned its large job into lots of little jobs. Okay, and whenever some machine on the network has some idle cycles, contact the server saying, I am ready to do some work, send me some work. So you send a small piece of work, the computation and the process move here, they get processed and you send the results back, and if you're still idle, you ask for the next job and so on and so forth. Okay, just one example. Now there are other scenarios, like you set up a large compute cluster. Okay. And here you can run compute intensive simulation jobs. Okay, this is run for scientific processing of data and whatnot. Okay. So you just submit jobs to this cluster, and this cluster usually has lots of nodes. Okay, there are lots of servers or processors, and when some processors on this system become overloaded and there are underloaded nodes on the system, some jobs can actually move from overloaded to underloaded nodes to do what is called load balancing. You're trying to balance the overall load on the system. Okay, that's what is actually mentioned there. So you have these scenarios, okay, where you can have both the data and the computation. So this is a generalization of data migration as well as computation migration. Okay, and the advantage you get by any system that supports job migration is that you get computational speed up because you are sharing resources in the system. Okay, well, effectively what we have done is we are able to share either processing resources or storage resources across the system. Okay, and that allows you to get higher execution speeds overall. So before we talk about remote procedure calls, I just want to introduce this notion of a client. Are there questions on computation migration, data or job migration? Okay, basic concept is clear, right? Okay. So before I talk about remote procedure calls, which is what we are going to focus the rest of today's class on, I want to introduce this notion of a client-server model. Okay? This is how many distributed applications are built. Okay? You probably heard of client-server system. Okay? So in a client-server system, which we distinguish from what are called peer-to-peer systems. Okay? These are a different form of building distributed applications. kind of client server system, there are two classes of processes in your system. There are servers and there are clients. Okay. So the server part of your system runs on more powerful machines, okay, and it provides certain functionality. Okay. And the client part of your system accesses the functionality that your server is providing to you. Okay. And many distributed applications are built this way. Okay. Web, the web is an example of a global scale client server system where there are web servers and the clients are browsers. Okay. Web servers store content. Okay, and the browsers go to the servers to access this content. Okay. Distributed file servers are also built in the same fashion. Okay, you might have, other than web servers, your file servers, which and the server has large disks that are stored a lot of data, and clients access files that are stored on remote machines. Okay. So whenever you create a network drive, for example, okay, you are accessing a remote file system. The machine where the data actually lives is acting as a server, and the machine that is mounting this network drive is acting as the client. Okay. Same is true of print servers. Okay. You may have machines that act as print that offer print services to many desktops, and whenever a client has a job to print, it sends it off to the print server, and the print server then sends it off to the actual hardware, okay, meaning the printer itself. So this client-server model, as I mentioned, is very popular for designing distributed systems. Okay? And there is this other class of models which are called peer-to-peer systems. Okay, you must have heard of P2P. The most common example of these are these file music sharing applications. Okay? Now the reason, the application is not important, but the notion of peer-to-peer is. So what happens in a peer-to-peer application is that no process is acting either purely as a client or purely as a server. Okay? Your process can be a client or a server or both, depending on what it is doing. Okay? So just to take the example of music sharing, if you are downloading a file from someone else, your process is the client and that process is the server. If it is the other way around, that you are actually allowing someone to download from you, the same process has actually become a server. Okay. The reason it's called peer-to-peer is because no process is more distinguished than the other. In a client-server model, server processes typically do more work than client processes. In a peer-to-peer system, your application processes can act as clients or servers or both. Okay. But there are many peer-to-peer applications. Skype is an example of a P2P application. Because then in this case what you have is you have two endpoints that are communicating with one another without any server in between. Okay, so a lot of these applications are adopting a P2P model. Okay, what do torrents count as?
Yeah.
So torrents are just seeding, so this is BitTorrent, right? So BitTorrent is a peer-to-peer application. But in order to figure out which peer to connect to, there's somebody stores the index. Okay, that's a torrent. So you first download the index and then you figure out which peer to connect to and then you download the data from that. So this is still a peer-to-peer model. But in order to enable peer-to-peer communication, you need to access a directory. Okay, in this case, the directory happens to be a torrent. Even Skype uses the same scenario. Okay, just if you want to start a Skype call, in order to figure out whether your friend is logged in, you first consult the Skype directory. And that tells you, yes, this person is logged in and they are at this IP address, and then your Skype client actually connects directly to that client. Okay, so many peer-to-peer systems use this notion of having an index that's separate from the data. Data communication goes peer-to-peer. Okay? Any other questions here? Okay, so now let's talk about remote procedure calls. Okay, so I already mentioned this idea before. Let's look at it in more detail. Okay, so here we'll just assume the client-server model. So there are clients. Let's take one client and one server. Okay, so the server provides a service, okay, to the client. The way it implements the service is through a set of methods that can be invoked by any remote client. Okay, so the service is implemented as set of methods, as I mentioned in this case. Let's make this a little more concrete. Let's assume that your lab 4 that you are doing is implemented as a remote procedure called server. So in this case, the methods that you would implement here would be create, delete, read, and write. Okay. These are functions that any client can invoke. Okay. And this is, in this case, this will become your file server. Okay. Now, clients can invoke this functionality by simply calling any of these methods. Okay. And as I mentioned, what is nice about this is that you just write the method and the underlying runtime takes care of figuring out how to manage the communication. Okay. So, the OS does all of the hard work. So, as far as the application designer is concerned, he or she doesn't have to worry about all of the network setup and so on. Okay. So let's see how RPCs actually work in a little more detail. Let me draw a picture here. On that the client, this is the server. So let's just take one method. So we have the create method. So you have written code for this method, and here is a client that says wants to invoke the create method. So you want to create a file called foo. Okay. All that the application designer has done is he has just said create and he said foo. Okay. Now somebody has to figure out that the create method actually lives on this machine. Okay. Somebody has to also figure out how do you invoke that create method over a network. Okay? How do you get the results back? Okay? And that somebody in this case is the RPC system. Okay? And what the RPC system does is it creates what's called a stub, okay, which is a part of the program that you link to each of your endpoints. Okay? The stub code actually does all of this communication. Okay? So what happens is when you initially call this create function, you have to find out where the server lives. Okay? This is called binding. Okay? Because you haven't specified that do a create and you haven't given me an IP address here. Okay? You didn't say I want to create. So I have to figure out where this create method lives on my network. Okay? For that, I have to do what is called binding. So I will look up a directory service saying which RPC process in this system actually exports the create method. Okay? And then there is a directory service somewhere. So when the server starts up, it registers with the directory service saying, I am this process and I export these set of methods. Okay, so if somebody wants to call these methods, tell them here is where I live. Okay, so the stub, not the application design. So stub is actually going to contact the directory service, figure out the address of the server. Once it has figured this out, it will actually set up a connection with the server. It may set up, let's say, TCP connection. Okay, or a UDP, doesn't matter. Okay. And then what it has to do, and this is where I think the RPCs, the notion of RPCs is very important, is that it has to create a message that says execute this method. And this is what is called marshalling of the argument. Okay, so what we have called here is creating the message and unpacking the message. This is called marshalling of arguments. Okay. And the reason all of this is important is that RPC systems do not assume that the client and the server are running on homogeneous machines. This could be a Windows machine running x86. This could be Mac OS X on PowerPC. Okay. And yet this process can talk to that process. Okay. Doesn't matter. Okay. Now, because there may be underlying differences in the architecture, underlying differences in the operating system, okay, the message formats that you have to use have to be interoperable, okay, across hardware architectures, across operating system platforms, and so on. Okay. And this is what this RPC system will do. So what RPC systems do typically is that they translate every message into a hardware independent format. Okay. Okay, this is often called XDR or external data representation. Okay. So you convert it into a platform neutral format and send it over. At the server end, you have to translate that back to whatever your format is. So if you are on a big Indian architecture, you have to translate the format into big Indian. If you are on a little Indian architecture, you have to translate it into little Indian. Okay. So once you unpack this message that has just come over the network, then you actually, the stub has to call the server process, say, I received a call for create with this argument. And then this executes as if you are executing a function call. Okay. It creates a response. Okay. This is a method, so it's going to return some values. So the value comes back. Okay. Again, you have to marshal it into a message, okay, convert that message or the return value, and then you send it back as a TCP/IP message. This comes back, and the create method may in this case return with a value, okay, with that indicated whether it succeeded or failed. Okay. So as far as the application program is concerned, it just looks like you made a local function call. Okay. It just so happens that this function call had to traverse over a network in order for it to be executed. Okay, is this clear? Yes, no? Any questions here? Okay, so let's look at some more detail here. So here are, so what is important is what is this magic that's happening underneath this? Okay, here things are fairly clean. Okay, you are just calling a function and this is returning a value. Okay, the application designer doesn't have to do much. So underneath, here are all the things. So you are building the message, you are sending the message, you wait for the response, get back the reply, and you return the result. This is what the client stub has to do. Okay. In the server stub, you are sitting in a loop waiting for messages. Multiple clients may send messages to the server at the same time. The server has to be able to handle this. So there may be arbitrary number of clients, all of them may call the create method at the same time. So you sit in a loop. So in other words, the server typically is multi-threaded. Okay, so it can serve concurrent requests. Okay, just as you had this project where you had multiple threads that were processing all these web requests all at the same time, that's the same kind of stuff here. Okay, so each thread sits in a loop, it waits for a command. Okay, when it gets a request, it unpacks the request parameter, then it calls the correct procedure. Okay, there may be multiple procedures here within the thread. It builds a reply and it sends off the reply. Okay? Any questions here? Okay, so let me ask a question. So what would happen if I called a function and pass the pointer? As I said, you can call a function as if it's a local function call. Yes. Okay, you have something to say?
I was about to say, well, if the server was trying to use it, then it'd have to go back to the client to get what's actually stored in that address.
Yes. Both of you are right. So if you just blindly pass a pointer, and here, so this is a memory location on this machine. Okay. So if you and you can just send off the pointer address. You come here and you try to dereference the pointer. This will just look like a local address here. So this address is not what was sent there. Okay. So if you just blindly pass pointers, it's not going to work. Okay. So typical RPC systems do not allow you to pass pointers for this very reason. Okay. Because pointers refer to memory locations on the local address space. When you're executing the procedure on a different machine, these two are two different address spaces. So this pointer value is meaningless in this address space. Okay, because you are actually pointing to a memory location here. Okay. So RPC systems will not allow you, RPC systems that are written for C and C++ will not allow you to actually pass pointers around. Okay. In Java, on the other hand, what you said happens, meaning you can actually pass objects by reference. Okay. And the Java, the JVM will actually do a network lookup. Okay, so you can actually pass an object by reference the object comes here, the object may be living on this machine, but then when this process or this method tries to access it, the JVM will actually send back a request to the client saying, I want to access this by reference, and then get access to it. So those are the things to consider. Now, so the reason C and C++ prohibited is lot more expensive to send pointers around. Okay. If I have to dereference a pointer and send a message back, there's another network lookup, network message to do a memory access. Okay, that's very expensive to do, so they just prohibit it altogether. Java, on the other hand, allows that flexibility, but that comes at the cost. Okay, the cost is you have to do network lookups of objects in this case. Okay. Is this clear? Any questions on this? Yes, you have a question.
If you do a function call on the client stuff, is the code of the function on the client? So if you create the thread and try to sign it to the process, does the server have to access the code from the client first?
No. So I think let me rephrase maybe what I said, and then you can ask the question if I didn't answer your question. So the server implements some methods. Okay. So I can explain it in the notion of Java, which you may be familiar with. So the server has an implementation. It also exports an interface. The client only has access to the interface. It doesn't have access to the implementation. So it can call some methods. Okay. And then you send off the request here and you execute the request there. Okay. So the server doesn't have any notion of what the client is going to do. It has only written these methods and say, here are three methods. Anybody can call these functions over the network. Okay. And then the client only knows that the server implements these methods, and the stub has to figure out where the client lives, but they don't know about one another directly. Okay. I'll show you an example of actually an RMI system, not an RPC system. Yes.
So the XDR kind of like a virtual machine in the sense that it's independent of the architecture.
It's not really virtual machine. All it is it's a platform independent format to encode things like integers and so. So I'll give you the reason why you have to do this. Let's suppose the client is big Indian and the server is little Indian. Okay. Suppose you are just sending an integer as an argument, not star I, but just I, and let's say the integer value is 4. Okay, so that's 0, 1, 0, 0. Okay. So if I just send these bits over, okay, and then just stick those bits into memory, now this is big Indian, these bits will get flipped. Okay. So I have to interpret these bits carefully, otherwise whatever I am sending as a bit stream over the network will look completely different on this architecture. So all that this is doing is it's saying in a language, rather a platform independent format, take integers and encode them this way. Okay, so it's like a translator. You translate all of your bits into this format and then this one translates them back. That's all. So it allows you to do big Indian, little Indian conversion. Okay, and things like that. Yes, your question there.
That.
So, if your servers and clients are of the same architecture, there are RPC systems that are optimized to run only on the same architecture, in which case you don't have to do this translation. You can just send the message as is because you know it's homogeneous. Whatever you send will be interpreted correctly at the other end. Okay? Now, all that said, this is not a huge overhead. Okay? The overhead in RPC system is actually sending the message over the network. It's not in local processing to create an XDR message. But if this is the internet, okay, message latencies on the internet are in the orders of hundreds of milliseconds. Doing this conversion is in the order of microseconds. So this is negligible as compared to the network hop you have to go over to access the server. So it's not a big deal in this. If you are on a LAN, the network latency may be in the order of milliseconds, but you are still here in tens or hundreds of microseconds. It's okay. Unless this is function with lots of argument. You could of course send an array. Okay. I could send a 1 megabyte array. I mean, there's nothing that limits me from the size of the argument. If I send an array, then I have to take the entire 1 megabyte array and convert it. Okay. In these extreme cases, that overhead may be large, but for anything reasonable, this is a negligible overhead. Okay. Any questions? Okay. So I already talked about all of this. How does the client know where the server lives? Okay, that's the first question. Typically, I mean, there are two ways to do this. One is you while you design your application, you say, I am going to run this server on this machine, and you hard code the address. Okay. Now, that's typically not a good idea, because if I want to run that server on some other machine, then I cannot do that. I have to recompile, change my code and recompile the application. Okay. So in most cases, this lookup on where the server lives is done dynamically at runtime. This is done using a directory service. In case of Unix like operating system, this is called the RPC port mapper. Okay. So this is a directory service. Whenever any application that exports an RPC interface starts up, they actually register with the port mapper. So any other client can then do a lookup saying, where is this application live, what port is it listening on, and the port mapper will return you that information, and then you know where to contact or who to contact. Okay. The application designer does not have to worry about this. Okay, so here you haven't specified when you do this anything. Okay, so this is in the general case is called a name service. It's essentially a lookup service that you have to figure out that tells you where the server lives. Okay, so what I will so similar concepts apply in Java. Okay, whatever I talked about in RPC system is true in Java, except that in the Java world, RPCs are called RMIs, or remote methods that you can invoke. Okay. But most of the objects, most of the concepts are very similar. Okay. So here you also have a naming service. This is a Java naming service. You can, when the server starts up, you can bind it to the naming service. Okay. So it binds the server to a name, and then the client stubs can do a lookup that tells you where does the object live on the network. Okay. So this is how you do this in the Java world. Yeah, so there is this RMI registry, which is implementing the naming service. There's an RMI compiler, okay, that you use to generate stubs, and I'll show you examples of programs and how you go about generating server and client stubs.
Those reside on the server, or those reside on the client?
The registry is a process that resides somewhere on the network. It neither has to reside on the server, nor does it have to reside on the client. It can reside somewhere. Typically, it resides on the same machine as the server, but it doesn't have to. This is a compiler. This is a tool that you use to generate code. When you're writing your application, you use this to generate these stubs that are then linked to the application. Okay. So in for C and C++, you would use something called RPCGem. Just as you call GCC or G++, you would actually call RPCGen, and it will then generate some code that you can then link against your application. The same is true in Java. You call RMIC. Just as you call Java C, you call this RMIC to compile and generate code. Okay, so let me show you an example. So here is a very simple Java RMI server. Okay, so it basically just allows you to call one function that prints hello world. Okay, so here is your interface. These are the remote methods that the server actually supports. Okay, so you say public interface hello, and it extends java.rmi, okay, .remote. Okay, so basically you have one remote method you can call, which is say hello. Okay, and it throws an exception, but that's not important here. Okay, that's the interface. Here is the implementation of the server. Okay, so the implementation basically just has this function. So you basically return hello world in the say hello method. Okay, this is all you actually write. You don't write any network socket code. Okay, so in this case, although this is a remote procedure or a remote method, and there's going to be network communication, as far as you, the programmer, is concerned, you are not writing any of the networking code. This is handled automatically for you by the stub. Yeah, this is why it is more powerful than doing all of the network socket communication yourself. Okay. Here is your Hello World server. Okay. So when the server starts up, it has to register itself, as I mentioned. That is basically called by naming rebind, and you say, I am a Hello World server. Okay. So now you're basically process started up, it's registered itself with the registry. Here the name server. and you also created a hello object in order to provide that method. And here is your client. Okay. So you are basically doing a naming lookup. Okay. So again, no IP addresses. You just do a name lookup saying I need to look up the hello world server. Okay. And then you just call that method. That is your remote method. Okay. Saying object.sayHello. Now what this client for Java program is running on a different machine than the others. Okay. So when you call that remote method, the underlying RMI system is going to set up a connection to the server. Okay. It's going to send this, construct a message saying this process wants to call the say hello method, send off a message. Okay. Exactly what I said here. It's going to arrive at the client stub. Client stub implements that say hello method, and then that just returns a string. So that string is then going to be taken as a return value. It comes back over the network and it comes in. But none of this is visible to you. The fact that you are calling a remote method isn't even visible. It just looks like you are called a local method. Okay. And yet this just looks, this is a distributed application. So this is why this is actually a very powerful way to design your distributed application. Because from an application standpoint, lot of the details, okay, of messy details of communicating with servers and all of that is hidden from you. Okay? Any questions on this? Is this clear? Okay, so that I can, if you are interested, I can actually bring some sample RPC programs, but they look exactly like the Java programs. And I figured this was a little easier to explain because all of you know Java better. Okay, so that's basically what we have for the day. So I have mentioned three ways of sharing resources in a distributed system: sharing of data, sharing of computation, and sharing of and job migration. And each is useful depending on what the exact scenario is. Okay, if the, in one case the data resides on fixed servers and the processes move around, in another case the processes reside on this, on some machines and the data moves around, and in job migration both move around. Okay, I introduced the client server model. Okay, what the notion of what is a client and what is a server, we distinguish that from the peer to peer model. Okay. And then we looked at this notion of a remote procedure call, and we said this is basically how one could write your distributed applications. And the way you do this is each process exports certain methods that can be called by other processes over the network. Okay. The nice feature here is that all the network communication details are handled by the underlying runtime and not by the application programmer. Okay. So that's all we have here. Next time what we are going to do is talk about distributed file system. Okay, so we are building one level at a time. So we looked at network protocol last time, and now we have looked at how two processes can communicate with one another and execute code on one another using the notion of remote procedure calls. And next time we are going to look at distributed file system. Okay, many distributed file systems actually are implemented using remote procedure calls. Okay, so when we talk about distributed file systems and NFS next time, we'll see how you can use this notion of RPCs to access files that are stored on disks that are on other machines. Okay, that's what a distributed file system allows you to do. Okay, so let's stop here. I do have the project to hand out, so I'll